let's. I'm gonna start, and you'll be glad to hear this morning's gonna be short. But I'll just open in prayer. If we're all here, James has had enough. Right, I'll open in prayer. Amen. Well done, everyone. If you haven't already clocked, and you weren't listening to Mark, today's instalment of Live Lent is on the Lenten practice of silence. So I thought we'd open in, well, silence. How was that for you? One word answers from around the room. You can speak now.
Surprisingly peaceful.
Lovely. Oh, good.
Calming.
Actually, sounds like I don't need to do a sermon on that. I was wondering if it might be slightly awkward, and an unannounced silence when someone's supposed to be speaking. The kind of the hum of London, doing a silence in Zone 1 London is not necessarily easy. But I'm glad everybody enjoyed it. I thought that was interesting because when I started to look at kind of the word silence and the way it's used in the Bible, it rarely had positive connotations. And this isn't decades of decades of study and Bible school talking, because I just googled silence and Bible, and there's plenty of it in the Bible, but here are a few of the kind of the references you get. In your unfailing love, silence my enemies, destroy all my foes, for I am your servant. So kind of go Psalms, and that's one of many where you get silence as violence. Nice rhyme, but not necessarily positive. Another one here. My God, whom I praise, do not remain silent. Another Psalm. Clearly God's gone AWOL. Not hearing from God. A sign of God's absence. Kind of a feeling of abandonment, so on and so forth. Another one, Lord, you've seen this, do not remain silent, do not be far from me. Again, not great. And then, this one's lovely because poetic. The joyful timbrels are stilled. The noise of the revelers has stopped. The joyful harp is silent. No longer do they drink wine with a song. The beer is bitter to its drinkers. Thanks, Isaiah. So you kind of got silence as lament. I just thought, in all of this, with all of those negative connotations, why have we ended up with silence as a kind of a Lenten practice? And despite kind of those, I don't know if this is your plan, Mike, but I was wondering if we might start to kind of use this series as a competition. It's a chance to sell a Lenten practice to you, kind of change your mind about it. You might not have done it before. Hopefully at the end of this one, you'll try this. You won't go for Vince's or whoever's next. So I thought setting up the fact that those are the associations that we have with the word silent or silence when it comes to the Bible, can we change your mind and get you to maybe think that silence would be a Lenten practice worth trying? I've got the advantage of having the spot right before Lent begins. Recency bias there. But before we get kind of onto silence proper and what's the point, it's probably helpful to start kind of by focusing on Lent and what Lent is. With that in mind, I'll give you some Bible. So Mark does a really handy pressy of kind of Jesus's time in the wilderness, which is, I guess, what Lent is supposed to mirror, the 40 days that Jesus spent in the wild before his ministry began. So what you get here from Mark is at once, this is kind of immediately after he's been baptized by John the Baptist, at once the Spirit sent him out into the wilderness, and he was in the wilderness 40 days, being tempted by Satan. He was with the wild animals, and angels attended him. So that's in Mark. And then we get, so Lent is essentially a period in the Christian calendar that mirrors that time in the wilderness before Jesus' ministry is kind of said to have begun in earnest. Jesus goes out into the desert. He's away from his family. He's away from friends, the luxury of food. There's temptation time and time again from Satan. And then only after that does Jesus kind of re-enter civilization, as it were, and begin his work in earnest. And I think perhaps if we're looking for a clue as to why we might have adopted silence as a Lenten practice, it's there in that passage a couple of times. And that clue is the word wilderness. I believe there's a link today between the word silence or the practice of silence and the idea of a wilderness. So what is a wilderness? Apparently, the word is derived from an old English term that I'm not going to pronounce it right. Wilderons. There you go. Which means place of the wild animals. And if you think about, or if you kind of look at kind of America, where they have massive wilderness parks, and you look at the way that they define them today, they're basically places that are untouched by humanity. They're places where, they're not necessarily places where humans never go, but where humans don't really have dominion. So they are places where nature is left to find its own path. They're a place kind of unconquered by humanity. And I think, I don't know if anyone here, I've had a couple of friends who've done mental trips in America where they've headed into these wilderness places, these massive untouched stretches of land. And that can be humbling. Scary, yeah. And so, whilst they can be beautiful and some of the pictures are stunning, they're not necessarily desolate, they can be full of life, it's just not human life at the forefront. So, for humanity, wilderness is potentially a place of disconnect, it's a place of discomfort. If you step into a wilderness, you are surrendering control. And anyone that ventures in is for all intents and purposes, kind of at the mercy of their surroundings. In a wilderness, we are very, very much small. And I don't know about you, and this was a real challenge for me in writing. It held a mirror up. Because I don't know about you, but in our kind of modern, postmodern, busy, connected lives, especially in a city and especially in town hamlets, silence can have a similar effect to that of a wilderness. I think there are kind of two elements to silence that kind of give that feeling and make silence no less kind of scary to us today. And in order to seek a silence, we have to do two things. First, we have to elect to stop ourselves from speaking and quiet ourselves. And secondly, this is much, much easier said than done right here, but we have to attempt to shut out the noise of the rest of the world. So kind of quieting the world around us, he says, as sirens blare past. We have to put down our media, put down our devices, step away from our friends and our closest people. And both of those acts are uncomfortable. As we elect to stop speaking, we lay down one of our key tools for agency and connection in the world. This is a way of kind of, I don't know about you, I was thinking about speaking at work in particular, and I'm not entirely sure that practicing silence for 40 days in the office would get me very far. But I was just thinking about how important speaking is to kind of forcing our view onto the world and making our interests known and taking control of a situation. We need to speak to do that, and to elect not to speak for any degree of time or in any environment is to lay down that tool at kind of imposing our will upon the world. And then secondly, as we attempt to kind of shut out the noise of the world around us, we have to choose to kind of close those apps that might distract us for hours on end, to turn off the music that moderates our mood or creates the atmosphere that we desire, or to switch off the TV that helps us escape from kind of the reality of the world. And this is not easy stuff. It's a stripping back and it's a stripping away. And to do those things, even for moments, can be confronting. Personal anecdote, as I kind of prepared this talk over the last couple of weeks. For me, a soundscape is hugely important. And Bethany knows this and has to bear with it. The moment I get out of bed, I put Radio 4 on. I actually find that the tones of the presenters very calming. Bethany hates the content because it's first thing you hear in the morning is genocide. And that's fair. But that's kind of the minute I get out of bed, I've got Radio 4 on. I get to work. I work in an open plan office. I put my headphones in so that I can concentrate on the thing that I want. I get home, I'm cooking, I've got an NTS playlist on so that the kitchen feels lovely and warm and so on and so forth. And each one of these things specifically for me is a way to control my environment. to make it more conducive to what I feel it needs to do to mirror the atmosphere that I want to create. And so putting those things down can feel really, really uncomfortable for me personally. And I do wonder kind of what that looks like for everyone else in this room. But again, yeah, surrendering control of kind of noise, the making of and the kind of the controlling of in our lives today is similarly as confronting, perhaps not quite as dangerous, but similarly as confronting as a wilderness. So the next, again, the logical kind of next question to ask is, why on earth, if you don't have to, would you seek a wilderness? It's a very good question. Why would I not control the environment around me? Well, I think for this, kind of just, we'll just kind of go a bit meta. The Bible is essentially one massive account of people wandering or being forced into a wilderness. If you think about it, it starts in Genesis as Adam and Eve distrust God and are cast out of the Garden of Eden into the wilderness. And I'm not spoiling anything for anybody here if I go, there is an arc in the Bible that ends up with us, you know, being brought back out of a wilderness as humanity into the kind of the embrace of God. But that story, that kind of narrative arc, kind of spirals and echoes time and time and time again throughout the Bible. So Adam and Eve, Jacob, Hagar, Moses, the Israelites again, probably the Israelites again, David, all of these guys, these groups, spend time in the wilderness. Now, does anybody know what happens in each of these stories? Valid. Seldom do they end in despair. So, Jacob, couple of accounts of him spending time in the in a wilderness, receives a promise from God. The next time, receives a blessing from God. Hagar, so Sarah's Egyptian slave, Hagar ends up in a desolate wilderness twice, and both times encounters God, who sees, hears, and sustains someone who'd been harmed and forgotten. Moses. In one of his kind of, you know, less smart moves, murders someone. So flees for his life into Midian's wilderness, which becomes the setting for his transformative encounter with God and his calling into a mission of liberation. The Israelites, we all know this story after Egypt, in a barren wilderness where food and water is almost impossible to find, Israel faces the threat of starvation and dehydration. And God uses these challenges to test them, inviting them to trust him more than ever before. And there's the manna from heaven. Again, as the Israelites face scarcity in the wilderness, God teaches them that life flows not from their own hands, but from God's word. David, hunted by King Saul, takes refuge in the wilderness, where his path to kingship comes, not by forceful dominance, but by learning to trust and depend on God. So, why seek a wilderness if we're to kind of learn anything from that pattern or that theme? Which I think is kind of there enough for us to assume that it probably wasn't a mistake. Why seek a wilderness? It's because that it's in a wilderness that God is met and that God is revealed. It's in a wilderness that we become aware of our frailties and crutches. It is in a wilderness that we can become aware of our dependence on God. It is in a wilderness that God can work, show us new stuff, and connect with us. So we see time and time again in the Bible, but what's going on as we commit to silence here today? And why is it like a wilderness? This is a weird one, and I don't have a full answer to it, and I feel like I'm kind of spinning out into something a bit mystic, but we'll go with it for now. I want to turn to one of the kind of the OG advocates of silence, Gregory of Nyssa. Mike, I'm meaning to ask, is Nyssa not Nicaea, isn't it? It's a different place, and I am pronouncing it right. Should have checked this before. Gregory of Nyssa. So he was a bishop of a place called Nyssa in the 300s. As an aside, he was one of the first people where we have kind of recorded writings of unambiguously coming out against all forms of slavery. So, decent bloke, maybe. he was a big fan of Moses. So much so, he wrote a book, or a scroll, probably, about Moses called The Life of Moses. And whilst I can't confess to having read it at all, let alone in its original Greek, I understand that one of the things Gregory was really, really intrigued by was Moses' ascent up Sinai and the time that he spent meeting with God. And in his writing, Gregory talks about Moses' kind of ascent to God in the context of two things. Aww. One, his lament over the, and I'm quoting from another author here, another theologian, his lament over the excessive talking of poorly educated preachers. and in another passage, he describes his ascent as a withdrawal from the world and a quieting and stilling of himself in the presence of God. So those kind of two elements that we kind of touched on before there, of one, quieting himself, and then two, getting away from the jibber-jabber of others, the chaos of the world. Gregory was such a fan of silence that one year in Lent, he spent the entire 40 days of Lent in complete silence. Didn't speak at all. And the guy I just quoted, Brian Matz, who's spent a lot of time studying this book that Gregory wrote about Moses, said there were two insights to be derived from Gregory's kind of time in silence. The first was that in silence, we strip ourselves of control and distraction, and as we do that, we encourage the unity of, and this just feels slightly hippie, but we encourage the unity of mind and body. Now, the Greek word that we tend to translate to, I say we, I've never done any translation into Greek, that us in the West tend to translate to mind or understanding, the word used by Gregory is the Greek nous, or spelt as we might understand it, N-O-U-S. Which I would read nous. Ringing any bells? And that has more of a kind of a potent meaning in the Greek than simply the word mind or brain or head as we might understand it today. Rather, if we kind of look a little bit at the kind of the Greek philosophy, when they talked about nous, they tended to be referring something deeper than mind. It was more to do with kind of an intrinsic intellect or a kind of a higher faculty, if you will. It was more kind of, if you prefer poetic language, it was the eye of the heart. As people kind of understood that, nous is less akin to brain and closer, perhaps, akin to soul. So Noos describes kind of a unique faculty which allows us to kind of perceive and receive God in a different way. And kind of the Greeks would say that all humans have this ability, this kind of intellectual acumen or spiritual sensitivity. It's dulled in a world that is busy, is noisy, is fast-paced, is one where we have an option to kind of exert control on it. So kind of stepping into silence is a way of helping nurture that connection between body and soul, a way of potentially helping ourselves feel more our whole selves. That wasn't enough. There's more. Gregory went on to say that as we find that unity within ourselves, we can begin again to direct our attention outward, but with a kind of a different view of the world, one that kind of turns our attention away from what we might consider sin, and more towards one that's kind of aligned or attuned to the world that God created and the world that God intends. So kind of put here by that bloke Brian Matz, we can turn more towards finding pleasure in the works and the wonders of God. So in the wilderness of silence comes God's drawing. This is a horrible sentence, and I don't know why I'm trying to read it verbatim. In the wilderness of silence comes God's drawing near and God's revelation for us. That's what's there if we embrace silence. And whilst I'm wrapping up, it wouldn't be a preach on silence or a preach on the subject of silence if I didn't cite this passage here. This is about Elijah. I roll. The Lord said, "Go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." Then a great and powerful wind tore the mountains apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake came a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire came a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. Then a voice said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And there begins Elijah's dialogue with God. There begins Elijah's kind of stepping back out into the world with direction about where to go next and what to say and what to do. And so kind of now, kind of, I just want to return to the beginning where actually you were all really well behaved and got what was going on much quicker than I thought you would, and you actually enjoyed it. So what I wanted here was a contrast between at the beginning what I wanted to term an awkward silence, and what I want to leave here at the end is another few minutes of silence where perhaps we don't think about it in the same way. I'm going to propose that we finish with a silence, but we reflect on what we've kind of been discussing here this morning and think about our kind of our own relationships each with silence or noise, depending on how you think about it. Think about kind of personally what you might find it uncomfortable. Think about what you might hope it looks like or feels like for the Noos and body to be in greater unity. Think about the revelation you'd like to experience after the discomfort of quiet or silence, and maybe think about this next little spot of I'm saying quiet here, not as an awkward silence, but perhaps as a pregnant pause, where we expect to kind of to meet and to hear from God. I'm gonna end there. What do we reckon? Maybe we do 4 minutes. And then I'll get up and just to signal we're not being silent anymore. But I'll stop for now.